Psalms are superscripts. I guess the tricky part is we're leaving out a lot of Psalms. So if you feel like, you know, you've been here through the summer and we've dealt with, I don't know, maybe a dozen Psalms, most of them have had this sort of flavor to them where it's David typically crying out to God saying, God, would you deliver me? God, would you save me? God, would you intervene on my behalf? Because I am up against something or someone, some situation, some circumstance, some person, and I don't have the strength or the skill or the wisdom to get out of it. There are other Psalms, and I just thought I'd mention this because if Psalms is a new book to you, you might think, oh, that's what they're all about. It's like some of them are full of praises to the Lord, celebrating the good things. Some of them are even harder. Some of them are actually what we would call laments. In other words, at a time of just brokenheartedness, God's word even teaches us how we walk through some of the griefs and heartaches of life. But these ones sort of have that flavor. And I guess David goes through a lot of hard things. I'm actually going to get us there in a few minutes. So my plan this morning, if all goes well, is to really try to do three things. I want to look at Psalm 142 and point out one specific thing coming out of it. Then I want to use that one specific thing. I want to take a step back and look at David's life, kind of not the whole thing, but a particular lesson that for me has come through loud and clear in my time just thinking about David, which goes actually all the way back to last winter when I was preparing for the men's retreat that I had the privilege of speaking at. And then I want to end with a question. And I know that sounds like a weird thing. You're just like, we come to church for answers, not more questions. But a question that I hope is fruitful, helpful as you journey with the Lord. So that's kind of the plan. So lesson from Psalm 42, then kind of a big picture lesson from David's life, and then a question. A couple weeks ago when Pastor Dave was preaching when we were on some vacation, he did a brilliant job of kind of walking through the conflict between David and Saul. So if you know the story, this is probably not news for you, but maybe it's a bit of a refresher. Israel has a king. They have chosen him because he looks like a king and he acts like a king and he's literally head and shoulders above everyone else. And when they said, hey, we want a king, we want someone who feels like a king, the answer was obvious. It was Saul. The only problem was Saul's character and his heart was not kingly, if I could put it that way. And so when God finally steps in and interrupts things and says, I'm about to bring a change, he rejects Saul as king and he anoints David. And there's a wonderful little line that shows up a number of times in scripture that man looks at the outward things and God looks at the heart. And that is really David's story. Because outwardly, David was the least likely in many ways to be king. At the time he is anointed by God for this role, he's probably about a 15-year-old young person. Many of us are like 15-year-old kid, but he's a very young man and he is anointed as king, but there already is a king. And this sets up this very difficult, a decade of David's life in actuality, where he is fleeing for his life because the existing king named Saul doesn't want competition, whose name is David. In fact, it'll take a full 22 years from the time that God anoints David as king of Israel until he fully realizes that promise and it's fulfilled in his life. And so I know some of us, it's like, man, if I have to wait for 2 months, you know, back when you're like 18, 19, 20, it's like, if I got to wait a year, these are the best years of my life and they're fleeting, right? So you think of what David's going through, 22 years from the time he's 15, so you can do the math. What is that, 37? Did I get that right? Somewhere in there. Spent waiting, spent running, spent uncertain, spent crying out to God because constantly facing difficulties, constantly facing dangers. But through it all, God does some amazing things. And like I said, I want to look to one of those. Now, we're going to look first real quick into Psalm 142. So because we're going to run out of time, I guarantee it, I'll just dive right into the deep end. So Aaron already read it for us. You quickly get the tone of it, right? David is in a difficult spot. He articulates in a variety of ways. He uses like the language of like prison. He's not literally in prison. He's literally in a cave. And you can actually read the story over in 1 Samuel 22 that corresponds to this. So if you actually want to, you know, get a little bit of the background, and we will go there in a few minutes. David is fleeing from Saul yet again, and he arrives at a cave, the cave of Adullam, and he He hides there because Saul is coming with his armies and David is all alone. And he appears to have kind of hidden in this cave from which there is no escape. And you start to pick up that sense as you read through the psalm as he's crying out to God. He's like, my spirit faints within me. This is verse 3. You know my way. In the path where I walk, they've hidden a trap for me. He's like, everywhere I turn, I realize there's just traps. There's no way out of this. It's almost like down to the point of literal sort of descriptions of like he's in a cave and there's no back door. There's no way out for David, but he's affirming, and it's very interesting all through the psalm. There's sort of high points. There's one in verse 3, one in verse 5, and one in verse 7, where it's like in the middle of his despair, he just remembers for a brief moment something true about the Lord. Yes, I'm crying out. Yes, I am in trouble, but you know the way. And then right back into, there's a trap, and verse 4 is probably the low point of the whole psalm. Look to the right and see, there is no one who takes notice of me. No refuge remains to me. There's nowhere left to hide. No one cares for my soul. That's a tough place. Some of you have been there. Maybe not the literal hiding out in a cave with an enemy, but at a spot where you go, you know what? I feel alone. David's there, crying out to the Lord. Verse 5, I cry out to you, O Lord. I say, you are my refuge. Notice how it's back and forth, right? It's like, I'm alone, but you're my refuge. Not only are you my refuge, you are my portion. In other words, he says, God, I don't trust in you for what I can get from you. You're not the one, you're not the means to the end. You're actually what I long for. And then, right back to, I'm brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors. They're too strong. Bring me out of prison that I may give thanks to you. The righteous will surround me, for you will deal bountifully with me. Again, it's this back and forth. I don't know if your prayers ever sound like that. I will admit, no one else has to raise their hands. Mine often do. If mine were written down and you could actually read them, like not as eloquent as that, I wish, not as beautiful. I wouldn't want you to read them, but certainly the tug of war of like, God, I need your help. I don't know what to do. I need you to get me through, around, over. It's like, but where are you, right? The low moment, and then it's like, hold on a second. I know you're right here with me. And this could all be in the same prayer. And then after that moment, it's like, but God, why aren't you coming through for me, right? It's like this, all through it. It's David, very similar sort of story. Now, The background of this, like I said, is 1 Samuel 22. What's interesting, don't look there yet. I know some of you are like, hey, let's just have a quick peek and see what's going on. Before you look there, the thing I want to point out for you is the fact that this is one of the rare cases where we have both the context. In other words, you can go to 1 Samuel 22 and you can read how David gets here. Then you've got his prayer, what he requests of God. And then we have God's answer, which is very amazing and very helpful to us. His request, if you see it, kind of the underlying theme here is he's alone and he wants God to provide someone to come alongside. It's there in verse 4, but it really capstones in verse 7. This is sort of the concluding thought. The righteous will surround me. You're going to deal well with me. You're going to deal bountifully with me. I'm not going to be alone because I know, God, I have come before you. I've cried out to you. I've asked you to bring someone, to bring the righteous around me so that I would not be alone anymore. Now, again, you don't have to answer this out loud, but just sort of think in your head of like, well, okay, so what would an answer to this prayer look like? The prayer is pretty simple. It's like, God, bring someone into my life who will care for me, righteous people who will surround me. I'll go first. I would expect then God to bring around David some really great people. Like maybe really like upright in character. Probably like practically speaking, it'd be great if they could bring some resources to the table. Remember, David's fleeing for his life. He's got nothing. So if they could kind of bring, you know, some military experience, maybe have some weapons, maybe bring some wagon loads of food or some money so David could get some resources. So in other words, they would come with stuff and they would be practically really helpful. And you could see it unfolding before your eyes, right? That's what it's like. Well, that would be a great way that God could answer the prayer. Oftentimes, I don't know about you, but when I pray, I often pray with a request and then with the proposed solution. Anyone else does this? It's like, Lord, I really need your help. We did this when we were over, long story short, we were looking for a house for a year and a half. And I'd pray. It's like, Lord, you know, we're looking for a place. And it would be great, Lord, if it would be about this many square feet and, in this kind of location, and we could use about this many acres and kind of be like this. And if it could be in this price range, Lord, kind of like God's like realtor.ca, right? Where you can click the variable things you want. It's like, God, here's my prayer and here's... David says, God, would you surround me with some righteous people who would help me so I'm not alone? 1 Samuel 22 is God's answer. It's not a long passage, so I'll read it for you. Leading up to it, it says, David departed from there. Well, the there is Gath, where he's run to flee from Saul, and he now needs to flee from Gath, and so he's running for his life. So he departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And this is the moment where he prays. So right somewhere in here, you can inject Psalm 142. David cries out to God, God, save me, deliver me, rescue me, send some righteous people to come alongside so I'm not alone. And here's God's answer. When his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. It's like, well, of course, your family's going to come, hopefully, right? Mom and dad show up. Now, I'm not sure that that's necessarily always an easier thing. David's fleeing for his life, and now he's got his mom there. He's going to have to find a place, you'll see a few verses later, to protect his family. But the real answer comes next in verse 2. And everyone who is incredibly talented, well-resourced, above board, held in high esteem, with military experience. It's like, well, hold on a second, that's a different version, right? Because the version that probably you're reading says something like, everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul came. The number was 400. Do you remember the prayer? God sent me someone to care for my soul, some righteous people to come alongside. And God's like, I'm going to answer your prayer, David. They have three criteria. They're distressed, they are bankrupt, and they're bitter. I don't know what that looks like. You know, can you imagine if there was like a gathering? These people, it's like Tuesday night. Everyone who's bitter in soul, we're going to meet in the youth room. Be like, man, that does not sound like a cheery group. David's alone in the cave, and now 400 people join him, and those are the criteria. And God says, there's your answer, David. There's your answer. Now, it's worth considering that on a number of levels. And we'll get to the bigger picture in just a second, because I think it illustrates something much bigger going on in David's life. But just the quick thought around prayer, three of them, actually. Number one would be, don't stop praying for things that to you might feel impossible. Like sometimes I think we come before God with our requests that feel like, well, I think God could answer this. This is manageable. And then there's the other things. I mean, to think of what David's praying. Here he is fleeing for his life, knowing that Saul, the king, the army is trying to kill him. And his prayer, the audacious prayer is, God, would you send some people to join me in this? Like, who in their right mind would sign up for such a task? It's like, hey, want to join this team? They're fleeing for their lives and they will probably die. God provides. He answers. Just a reminder, there might be things that you've stopped praying for, or maybe just decided, I can't even pray for that. That's just too big. Oh, you can pray for someone who has a cold and someone who's this, but some of the deepest things, the issues that you are carrying around, the brokenness, the failures, the addictions, those things that just like constrict who you are, bring those before God. That's the first one. The second thing is, this is me speaking to me. Don't be surprised when God's answer doesn't look necessarily like the checklist. God, here's the request, and here's how I want you to answer it, and God's answer might look massively different. Now, we've sung about it all morning. It was actually great. I appreciated the songs Callie picked, because They fit so well. We sung of God's greatness. We actually sung lyrics from Romans 8, which we're going to get to in a few minutes' time, that God works all things together for our good. Now, it is a particular goodness, right? Again, it comes back to, it's like, well, I know what's good. If God's going to work all things together for my good, then it's going to look like this. And God might say, actually, I have an even better plan, an even wiser plan, and an even better end, a goal in mind that I'm working towards. And so the prayers might get answered differently than what you expect. And so I know even in this room, certainly in first service, because I've had conversations, we've got people saying, I'm praying for this thing, and here is what I hope God will do to answer the prayer request. Don't be caught off guard when the answer God gives you maybe doesn't even register at first as an answer. It might even at first look like an additional problem. It's like, God, I was asking for a solution. Now there's 400 misfits and my mom. But in the middle of all that, God was at work. God might answer your prayers in a way that feels at first similar to that. What's amazing about the story is those 400 misfits, if you read through the rest of the story, it's not immediate, it's not instantaneous. In fact, the very next story, David takes these 400 men and says, we're going to go into battle. And their response is like, no, we're not. It's terrifying. We're not soldiers. David's like, yeah, but God's called us to. And they do, and God is there with them, and they win a victory. The next chapter is another cave scene in 1 Samuel 24. This group of misfits is now with David in the next cave. When Saul comes in, it's this great story that there's never going to be a flannel graph to illustrate. Saul comes in to relieve himself in the cave. And if you remember this story, these guys say something to this effect. It's not an exact quote, but this will get you real close to the intent. It's like, David, God has worked in a providential way. He's handed Saul into your hands so you can kill him. Right? Because they're looking at the circumstances. Saul's been with an army, and now he's on his own. He snuck into this cave. There's David with his soldiers. Like, we can kill him, and all of our problems, they'll be gone, which would have been true for these 400 men. You think, like, they threw their lot in with David, right? Think of this for a moment. They came from some very difficult circumstances. They are now traitors. They switch teams. They're with David. The faster they can get rid of Saul and the faster David could become king, maybe David would, you know, he would reward them. He'll wipe the slate clean. Your debts are paid and we're going to give you land and not knight them, but whatever the equivalent would have been in David's day, giving them status and honor. It's like, if we could just get rid of Saul. And so they come to David. It's like, David, you could kill him. God has arranged this, David. Be very careful, by the way, of using circumstance, or what we might label sometimes as providence, as the first criteria in determining the will of God. It's maybe part of the package, but it's got to be down a few notches. I'm so thankful that David understands that the first criteria is God's word. Like, what has God told me? It's like, don't touch the Lord's anointed. And David's response to them is, I'm not going to do it. And verse 7 tells us of 1 Samuel 24, he actually persuades these men not to kill Saul. It's no small task, right? Saul's dead. All their wildest dreams now are ready to come true. But David says, we're not going to do it. Sometimes, like I said, providence, we call it, you know, if you hang around church long enough, we get this whole lingo around it. It's like, open doors, open windows, close windows. And it's like, it's very confusing stuff, right? Essentially, what we usually mean is, hey, if something comes easy, that must be God. He's just made it really easy. If something's hard, oh, he must have closed the door. And I know some of you are smiling. It's because you have learned something. It's like, just because something's hard doesn't mean that God isn't in it. And sometimes the easiest things aren't there because God is directing us. It's there because there is a temptation before us that looks so easy to grab hold of. And we need the strength of God to resist. And David's learning all this through all this time. These men are slowly learning this along with him. What's amazing, and I'll fast forward to the end of the story of these men become the heroes. These men become the backbone of David's army. For some of you, you would know some of the stories of David's 30 mighty men. These are them. These are the great men of valor and courage. Oh, they don't start off that way, but they end up that way. They end up as the men who would be beside David through thick and thin, putting their life on the line. One of them in one battle alone killed 800 men. Another fought through a battle. You can go read the story. He fought until the point where they couldn't pry his hand off his sword. Have you ever done that, where you're out working and your hand's kind of like, you're using a tool so long, you hammer all day. It's like, huh, my hand's now shaped like this. He just wouldn't give up. He wouldn't leave the battlefield. He was so committed to stand by David's side. The very thing that David longed for, God answered it in the end, but it was a very circuitous route. And God might be working in your life in the exact same way. The third point on this whole prayer thing is maybe somehow through all of God's working, you're actually the answer to someone else's prayer. Like usually we tend to think of ourselves like what I need, God, what you need to provide me. God, I need people around me like David. I need friends. But maybe God's at work bringing you around someone else. And then the instant reaction and the instant thought in my mind is like, well, God could do a lot better than me in answering someone else's prayer. But God brought 400 people who were debtors, discontents, and bitter of soul to become the backbone of David's army, his closest friends, his closest confidants, those men who would stand by him through thick and thin. God might be using you in the exact same way in someone else's life. Now, okay, what I want to do now is I want to take one step back from this and just kind of look now at the bigger picture of David's life using this as just one example of what I think could be many examples that would illustrate the same point. In 1 Samuel 13, I think it's around verse 22, somewhere in there, God has rejected Saul. This is the situation, and he has announced to Samuel that he is going to seek a man after his own heart. It's an incredible moment. It's like, I don't need Sauls. I need something different. I need people who will trust me, who will become dependent upon me. Now, here's my theology at play, and you're welcome to come and we can talk about this afterwards, but I read places like Romans chapter 3 that tell me that there is no one righteous, no one seeks after God, right? So if you think of what God's saying in 1 Samuel 13, where he says, I'm going to go seek someone whose heart is after me, and you read the rest of scripture and find out there's actually not a person on the planet who seeks God, you realize we have an interesting little problem. So what is it that God is going to do? Is it like playing, you know, hide and seek, where God's saying, hey, somewhere out on this planet, this giant globe called Earth, there is one righteous person. And if I can track down that person, that's going to be the person that I can choose to be king. My answer would be, that's not what God's saying at all. He's actually saying something much more akin to what Pharaoh says about Moses all the way back at the early part of Exodus, where Pharaoh uses the exact same word when he says, I am going to seek Moses to kill him. And he doesn't just mean, I'm going to go try to find him. He means I'm going to plan and I'm going to prepare and I'm going to do everything I need to do to terminate his life. If we're to translate that to the 1 Samuel 13, I think it would work out something like this. God's saying, I'm going to go find someone. And then I'm going to work in that person's life in such a way that by the time I was done, you'd be able to step back and say, that is a person who seeks after God. It didn't start that way. It's not some natural inherent character in David. It's the process that God uses to change and transform him, which according to Acts 13, looking back in retrospect, God did. That's the great statement. That's the great concluding statement of David's life. God has made him a man after his own heart. Somehow from the point where David is this 15-year-old young shepherd boy, to the point where he is done the story, God has transformed him. And the reason I think it's important is because I think that's what God is up to in all of our lives. He's still seeking men and women who would be seeking his heart. Now, what's the path? Oh, here's where it gets really painful and uncomfortable. And I wish I could say, well, the path, good news. The path is easy. Like you follow God, it's just like a piece of cake. That's how you'll know you're in the will of God. Everything will just be easy and wonderful, and there'll never be a difficult day. But you know that's not the story of David's life. You remember how it really starts in 1 Samuel 17, and it actually is a brilliant chapter. You just got to read it sometime through this lens. Goliath gets up on the other side of a battlefield, and he literally says to the Israelite army, send me a man. And you read through the rest of the chapter. Sometimes do this. Just circle every time that man or men or boy is mentioned. And that's what's going on in 1 Samuel 17. All the men of Israel, when they hear that, they're like, eh, he's kind of scary. It's probably someone else. It's probably you. Right? And Saul comes along. He's like, I will give the man who goes out there, I will give him great riches. And David shows up. He's just a boy. He's like, what are all the men doing? I'm not making this up. You go read this chapter. The men are all standing around looking for a man who'll go out and fight the guy who keeps calling for a man. And then Saul comes along. He's like, but you're just a boy. And David then says, yeah, but remember God. And by the time they get to the end of the chapter, it's just this moment. Saul's like, whose son is this boy? And by that time, oh, we've seen through it, right? We're reading through this. It's, that's not a boy. He's the only man. What makes him a man? Is it because he's courageous and full of valor? It's like, no. The only criteria that makes him a man is that he was the only one there to say, I'm willing to depend fully on God. That's the criteria. What is God looking? He's looking for people who would be fully dependent on him. That's the story of David's life. Now, what does it take for us to grow in dependence on God? Here's the hard part. It takes going through hard things. It takes going through a situation where it's like, I can't fix this. I don't have the strength or the wisdom to see myself through this. I don't have enough money to buy my way out of this. God, here I am again. Remember Psalm 142? Lord, I need a refuge. This is David. This is David learning what it looks like to be a man after God's own heart. This is what I think it's important for us to see, that when we sign up and say, I'm going to make Jesus my Lord and Savior, this is what we're signing up for. We're saying, God, I trust you, and I trust in your greatness, and I trust in your wisdom. And I believe that even if I was to go through something hard, that you could use that very thing for something good. Isn't that what Paul talks about in Romans 8? Let me get you there real quick before we come to the communion table. Romans 8 is probably the textbook statement on the very thing that David's life is illustrating. Romans 8 is all about how do followers of Jesus deal with difficult things, because you don't need to be told Romans 8:28 when everything's good, right? Romans 8:28, here's what it says. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, right? If everything's going good, you don't need to be told that things are gonna be, you know, working together for good, right? If you are just, you know, I was making it up off the spot in the first service, but I said, you know, like, you get a new job, and then in 3 weeks, you get like 2 promotions and each time a pay raise. And by the way, you've just lost 10 pounds and you weren't even trying. And everyone's like, wow, you look great. And your spouse just loves you, and your kids are just doing great in life, and everything is just going up and to the right, and your hair starts growing back, and you go to the dentist, and the dentist is like, hey, whatever you're doing, your gums aren't receding. They're actually growing. This is great. You should eat more bad things for you, right? If everything's going good, you don't need a verse to come along and says, hey, God will work all things together for good. You get the point, right? You don't need to be told that when things are all good. You need to know that when things are difficult, that God is going to take even those things and in his gracious, mighty hand, see a way through, that those things end up working for your good. Now, what good? God's gonna provide that detail, because left to our own devices, it's like, well, I know what good is. It's gonna be really comfortable. And God says, no, the good that you need is to be conformed to the image of his son. You need to be made to be like Jesus. Now, some of us, maybe that doesn't sound very exciting. I guarantee you, the day you die, being like Jesus will be the best thing that could ever happen. He's the only one who's beaten death. He's the only one who can stand before a righteous God, perfectly righteous, and then do it on our behalf so we can be saved. Like, trust me, if this doesn't sound good yet, one day you will be so thankful that God has grabbed a hold of your heart, sought you out, and is making you like the Son he loves. That passage goes on and speaks of this great Bible truth called justification. Don't ever let that word, maybe it sounds foreign to you. Don't ever let that like cause you to go, I can't understand that. It is the greatest truth. It's actually what this table really represents. It's a bunch of sinful people just like us who don't seek after God. being loved enough by God that he would send his one and only son to die on a cross, to shed his blood, that his body would be broken. That's what the bread and the cup represent. A little piece of bread, a little cup of juice, it's a reminder to us of what Jesus did, that he died on a cross in our place and took upon himself our sin, that when we trust in him, we can be forgiven. And then scripture says it's not done there. We then get credited to our spiritual account before God, the righteousness of Christ. It's not just that you get forgiven and you're back to a zero balance in your, you know, your spiritual account. You get forgiven and you are deposited into your account all the righteousness of Jesus, and that's what salvation's about. And that's what Romans 8 is really saying, and God then takes those people who have been saved by his grace, and he spends his goodness and his power conforming us to the image of the Son he loves through all the ups and downs. Don't get me wrong. It's not like, hey, sign up to follow Jesus and everything will be horrible so that you learn. There are joys. In fact, Jesus says, you know, no one who followed me is going to regret it. You don't look back and start counting the cost and saying, yeah, but look at what we gave up to follow Jesus. I'm going to take care of my people. But there's a journey. There's a process. David learned it, and I hope we will have enough faith in the greatness of our God that we would learn it.